Prabhupada lived in the Bowery, sitting under a small light, while hundreds of derelicts also sat under hundreds of naked lights on the same city block. He had no more fixed income than the derelicts, nor any greater security of a fixed residence. Yet his consciousness was different. He was translating Srimad Bhagavatam into English, speaking to the world through his Bhaktivedanta purports. His duty, whether on the 14th floor of a Riverside Drive apartment building or in a corner of a Bowery loft, was to establish Krishna consciousness as the prime necessity for all humanity. He went on with his translating and with his constant vision of a Krishna temple in New York City. Because his consciousness was absorbed in Krishna's universal mission, he did not depend on his surroundings for shelter. Home for him was not a matter of bricks and wood, but of taking shelter of Krishna in every circumstance. As Prabhupada had said to his friends uptown, "Everywhere is my home," whereas without Krishna's shelter, the whole world would be a desolate place. Often he would refer to a scriptural statement that people live in three different modes: goodness, passion, and ignorance. Life in the forest is in the mode of goodness. Life in the city is in passion, and life in a degraded place like a liquor shop, a brothel, or the Bowery is the mode of ignorance. But to live in a temple of Vishnu is to live in the spiritual world, Vaikuntha, which is transcendental to all three material modes. And this Bowery loft, where Prabhupada was holding his meetings and performing kirtan, was also transcendental. When he was behind the partition, working in his corner before the open pages of Srimad Bhagavatam, that room was as good as his room back at the Radha Damodar temple in Vrindavan. News of the Swami's move to the Bowery loft spread, mostly by word of mouth, at the Paradox restaurant, and people began to come by in the evening to chant with him. The musical kirtans were especially popular on the Bowery, since the Swami's new congregation consisted mostly of local musicians and artists who responded more to the transcendental music than to the philosophy. Every morning he would hold a class on Srimad Bhagavatam, attended by David Allen, Robert Nelson, and another boy, and occasionally he would teach cooking to whoever was interested. He was usually available for personal talks with any inquiring visitors or with his new roommate. Although Prabhupada and David each had a designated living area in the large loft, the entire place soon became dominated by Prabhupada's preaching activities. Prabhupada and David got along well together, and at first, Prabhupada considered David an aspiring disciple. April 27th, he wrote to his friends in India, describing his relationship with David Allen. "He was attending my class at 72nd Street along with the others, and when I experienced this theft case in my room, he invited me to his residence. So I am with him and training him. He has good prospect because already he has given up all bad habits. In this country, illicit connections with women, smoking, drinking, and eating of meat are common affairs. Besides that, there are other habits, bad habits like using only toilet paper and not bathing after evacuating, etc. But by my request, he has given up 90% of his old habits. He is chanting Maha Mantra regularly. So I am giving him the chance, and I think he is improving. Tomorrow, I'll have arranged for some prasadam distribution, and he has gone to purchase some things from the market." When David first came to the Bowery, he appeared like a clean-cut college student. He was 21, 6 feet tall, blue-eyed, handsome, and intelligent-looking. Most of his new friends in New York were older and considered him a kid. David's family lived in East Lansing, Michigan, and his mother was paying $100 monthly to sublease the loft. Although he did not have much experience, he had read that a new realm of mind expansion was available through psychedelic drugs. and he was heading fast into the hot, hazardous world of LSD. His meeting with the Swami came at a time of radical change and profoundly affected his life. David, it was a really good relationship I had with the Swami, but I was overwhelmed by the tremendous energy of being that close to him. It spurred my consciousness very fast. Even my dreams at night would be so vivid of Krishna consciousness. I was often sleeping when the Swami was up, because he was up late in the night working on his translations. That's possibly where a lot of the consciousness and dreams just flowed in, because of that deep relationship. It also had to do with study in Sanskrit. There was a lot of immediate impact with the language. The language seemed to have such a strong mystical quality, the way he translated it word for word. Prabhupada's old friend from uptown, Robert Nelson, continued to visit him on the Bowery. He was impressed by Prabhupada's friendly relationship with David, who he saw was learning many things from the Swami. Mr. Robert bought a small American-made hand organ, similar to the Indian harmonium, and donated it to David for chanting with Prabhupada. At 7 in the morning, Mr. Robert would come by, and after Bhagavatam class, he would talk informally with Prabhupada, telling his ideas for making records and selling books. He wanted to continue helping the Swami. They would sit in chairs near the front window, and Mr. Robert would listen while Prabhupada talked for hours about Krishna and Lord Chaitanya. New people began coming to see Prabhupada on the Bowery. Carl Jagerns, a 30-year-old black man from the Bronx, had attended Cornell University and was now independently studying Indian religion and Zen Buddhism. He had experimented with drugs as a psychedelic tool, and he had an interest in the music and poetry of India. He was influential among his friends and tried to interest them in meditation. He had even been dabbling in Sanskrit. Carl, I had just finished reading a book called The Wonder That Was India. I had gotten the definition of a sannyasi and a brahmachari so far. There was a vivid description in that particular book of how you could see a sannyasi coming down the road with his saffron robe. It must have made more than just a superficial impression on me, because it came to me this one chilly evening. I was going to visit Michael Grant, probably going to smoke some marijuana and sit around, maybe play some music. And I was coming down Hester Street. If you make a left on the Bowery, you can go up to Mike's place on Grand Street. But it's funny that I chose to go that way, because the shorter way would have been to go down Grand Street. But if I had gone that way, I would probably have missed Swamiji. So I decided to go down Hester and then make a left. All of a sudden, I saw in this dingy alcove a brilliant saffron robe. As I passed, I saw it was Swamiji knocking on the door, trying to gain entrance. There were two bums hunched up against the door. It was like a two-part door. One of them was sealed and the other was locked. The two bums were lying on either side of Swamiji. One of these men had actually expired, which often happened, and you had to call the police or health department to get them. I don't think I saw the man lying in the doorway until I walked up to Swamiji and asked, "Are you a sannyasi?" And he answered, "Yes." We started this conversation about how he was starting a temple, and he mentioned Lord Chaitanya and the whole thing. He just came out with this flow of strange things to me right there in the street. But I knew what he was talking about somehow. I had the familiarity of having just read this book and delved into Indian religion. So I knew that this was a monumentous occasion for me, and I wanted to help him. We banged on the door, and eventually we got into the loft. He invited me to come to the kirtan, and I came back later that night for my first kirtan. From that point on, it was a fairly regular thing, 3 times a week. At one point, Swamiji asked me to stay with him, and I stayed for about 2 weeks. It was perhaps because of Kyle's interest in Sanskrit that Prabhupada began holding Sanskrit classes. Kyle and David and a few others would spend hours learning Sanskrit under Prabhupada's guidance. Using a chalkboard he found in the loft, Prabhupada taught the alphabet, and his students wrote their exercises in notebooks. Prabhupada would look over their shoulders to see if they were writing correctly and would review their pronunciation. His students were learning not simply Sanskrit, but the instructions of Bhagavad Gita. Each day he would give them a verse to copy in the Sanskrit alphabet, transliterate into Roman alphabet, and then translate word for word into English. But their interest in Sanskrit waned, and Prabhupada gradually gave up the daily classes to spend time working on his own translations of Srimad Bhagavatam. His new friends may have regarded these lessons as Sanskrit classes, but actually they were bhakti classes. He had not come to America as the ambassador of Sanskrit. His Guru Maharaj had ordered him to teach Krishna consciousness. But since he had found in Kyle and some of his friends a desire to investigate Sanskrit, he encouraged it. As a youth, Lord Chaitanya had also started a Sanskrit school with the real purpose of teaching love of Krishna. He would teach in such a way that every word meant Krishna. And when his students objected, he closed the school. Similarly, when Prabhupada found that his students' interest in Sanskrit was transitory, and since he had himself had no mission on behalf of Sanskrit linguistics, he gave it up. By the standard of classical Vedic scholars, it takes 10 years for a boy to master Sanskrit grammar. And if one does not start until his late 20s or 30s, it's usually too late. Certainly none of Swamiji's students were thinking of entering a 10-year concentration in Sanskrit grammar. And even if they were, they would not realize spiritual truth simply by becoming grammarians. Prabhupada thought it better to utilize his own Sanskrit scholarship and translating the verses of Srimad Bhagavatam into English, following the Sanskrit commentaries of the previous authorities. Otherwise, the secrets of Krishna consciousness would remain locked away in the Sanskrit. Teaching Carl Jaeger's Devangari Sanhi verb conjunctions and noun declarations was not going to give the people of America transcendental Vedic knowledge. Better that he utilized his proficiency in Sanskrit for translating many volumes of the Bhagavatam into English for millions of potential readers. Carol Baker came from an immigrant Catholic background, and she immediately associated with Catholicism, the Swami's presence as a spiritual authority, and his devotional practices of chanting on beads and reciting from Sanskrit scriptures. Sometimes she would accompany Prabhupada to nearby Chinatown, where he would purchase ingredients for his cooking. He would cook daily, and sometimes Carol and others would come by to learn the secrets of cooking for Lord Krishna. Carol, he used to cook with us in the kitchen, and he was always aware of everyone else's activities in addition to his own cooking. He knew exactly how things should be. He washed everything and made sure everyone did everything correctly. He was a teacher. He used to make chapatis by hand, but then one day he asked me to get him a rolling pin. I brought my rolling pin and he appropriated it. He put some men on rolling chapatis and supervised them very carefully. I made a chutney for him at home. He always accepted our gifts graciously, although I don't think he ever ate them. Perhaps he was worried we might put in something that wasn't allowed in his diet. He used to take things from me and put them in the cupboard. I don't know what he finally did with them, but I am sure he didn't throw them away. I never saw him eat anything that I had prepared, although he accepted everything. Prabhupada held his evening meetings on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, just as he had uptown. The loft was out of the way most of his acquaintances, and it was on the Bowery. A cluster of sleeping derelicts regularly blocked the street entrance level, and visitors would find as many as half a dozen bums to step over before climbing the four flights of stairs. But it was something new. You could go and sit with a group of hip people and watch the Swami lead kirtan. The room was dimly lit, and Prabhupada would burn incense. Many casual visitors came and went. One of them, Gunther, had vivid impressions. Gunther, you walked right off the Bowery into a room filled with incense. It was quiet. Everyone was talking in hushed tones, not really talking at all. Swamiji was sitting in front of the room and in meditation. There was a tremendous feeling of peace, which I had never had before. I'd happened to have studied for 2 years to become a minister and was into meditation, study, and prayer. But this was my first time to do anything Eastern or Hindu. There were lots of pillows around and mats on the floor for people to sit on. I don't think there were any pictures or statues. It was just Swamiji, incense, and mats, and obviously the respect of the people in the room for him. Before we went up, Carl was laughing and saying how Swamiji wanted everyone to use the hand symbols just correctly. I had never played the symbols before, but when it began, I just tried to follow Swamiji, who was doing it in a certain way. Things were building up, and the sound was building up, and then someone was doing it wrong. And Swamiji just very, very calmly shook a finger at someone when they looked, and then everything stopped. He instructed this person from a distance, and this fellow got the right idea, and they started up again. After a few minutes, the sound of the cymbals and the incense, we weren't in the Bowery any longer. We started chanting Hare Krishna. That was my first experience in chanting. I'd never chanted before. There's nothing in Protestant religion that comes even close to that. Maybe Catholics and the Hail Marys. But it's not quite the same thing. It was relaxing and very interesting to be able to chant, and I found Swamiji very fascinating. The loft was more open than Prabhupada's previous place uptown, so there was less privacy. And here some of the visitors were skeptical and even challenging, but everyone found him confident and joyful. He seemed to have far-reaching plans, and he had dedication. He knew what he wanted to do and was single-handedly carrying it out. It was not one man's job, he had said, but he went on doing all he could, depending on Krishna for the results. David was beginning to help, and more people were coming by to visit him. Almost all of Prabhupada's Bowery friends were musicians or friends of musicians. They were into music. Music, drugs, women, and spiritual meditation. But because Prabhupada's presentation of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra was both musical and meditative, they were automatically interested. Prabhupada stressed that all the Vedic mantras or hymns were sung. In fact, the words Bhagavad Gita meant the song of God. But the words of the Vedic hymns were incarnations of God and in the form of transcendental sound. The musical accompaniment of hand cymbals, drums, and harmonium was just that, an accompaniment, and had no spiritual purpose independent of the chanting of the name of God. Prabhupada allowed any instrument to be used as long as it did not distract from the chanting. Carol. It was very interracial, music-orientated scene. There were a few professional musicians and a lot of people who enjoyed playing or just listening. Some people were painting in some of the lofts, and that's basically what was going on. We had memorable kirtans. One time, there was a beautiful ceremony. Some of us went over early to prepare for it. There must have been 100 people who came by that day. For the Bowery crowd, sound was spirit and spirit was sound, an emerging of music and meditation. But for Prabhupada, music without the name of God wasn't meditation. It was sense gratification, or at most a kind of stylized and personal meditation. But he was glad to see the musicians coming to play along in his kirtans, to hear him and to chant responsively. Some, having stayed up all night playing somewhere on their instruments, would come by in the morning and sing with the Swami. He did not dissuade them from their focus on sound, and rather he gave them sound. In the Vedas, sound is said to be the first element of material creation. The source of sound is God, and God is eternally a person. Prabhupada's emphasis was on getting people to chant God's personal transcendental name. Whether they took it as jazz, folk music, rock, or Indian meditation made no difference, as long as they began to chant Hare Krishna. Carol. Whenever he had the chanting, the people were fairly in awe of the Swami. On the Bowery, a kind of transcendence came out of the ringing of the cymbals. He used the harmonium, and many people played hand cymbals. Sometimes he played the drum. In the very beginning, he stressed the importance of sound and the realization of Godhead through sound. That was, I suppose, the attraction that most musicians found in him. The emphasis on sound as a means to attaining transcendence and the Godhead. But he wanted a serious thing. He was interested in discipleship. One serious newcomer was Michael Grant. Mike was 24. His father, who was Jewish, owned a record shop in Portland, Oregon, where Mike grew up. After studying music at Portland's Reed College and at San Francisco State, Mike, who played the piano and many other instruments, moved to New York City, along with his girlfriend, hoping to get into music professionally. But he quickly became disenchanted with the commercial music scene. Playing in nightclubs and pandering to commercial demands seemed particularly unappealing. In New York, he joined the Musicians Union and worked as a musical arranger and as an agent for several local groups. Mike lived on the Bowery in an AIR loft on Grand Street. It was a large loft where musicians often congregated for jam sessions. But as he turned more and more to serious composing, he found himself retiring from the social side of the music scene. His interest ran more to the spiritual, quasi-spiritual, and mystical books he had been reading. He had encountered several swamis, yogis, and self-styled spiritualists in the city and had taken up hatha yoga. From his first meeting with the Swami, Mike was interested and quite open, as he was with all religious persons. He thought all generally religious people were good, although he did not care to identify himself with any particular group. Mike. There was a little bit of familiarity because I had seen other swamis. The way he was dressed, the way he looked, older and swapthi, weren't new to me. But at the same time, there was an element of novelty. I was very curious. I didn't hear him talk when I first came in. He was just chanting. But mainly, I was waiting to hear what he was going to say. I had already heard people chant before. I thought, why else would he put himself into such a place without any comforts, unless the message he was trying to get across is more important than his own comfort? I think the thing that struck me the most was the poverty that was all around him. That was curious, because the places that I had been before had been just the opposite, very opulent. There was a Vedanta Center in Upper Manhattan and others. They were filled with dead older men and their leather chairs and pipe tobacco, that kind of environment. But this was real poverty. The whole thing was curious. The Swami looked very refined, which was also curious, that he was in this place. When he talked, I immediately saw that he was a scholar and he had spoke with great conviction. Some statements he made were very daring. He was talking about God, and that was all new. To hear someone talk about God, I always wanted to hear someone I could respect talk about God. I always liked to hear religious speakers, but I measured them very carefully. When he spoke, I began to think, Well, here is someone talking about God who may really have some realization of God. He was the first one I had come across who might be a person of God who could feel really deeply. Prabhupada is lecturing. Sri Krishna is just trying to place Arjuna on the platform of working in pure consciousness. We have already discussed for many days that we are not this dull body, but we are consciousness. Somehow or other, we are in contact with matter. Therefore, our freedom is checked. Attendance is better now that it has been uptown. The loft offers a larger space. In fact, the platform where Prabhupada sit nearly equals the entire area of his office cubicle on 72nd Street. The dingy loft with its unpainted rafters is more like an old warehouse than a temple. The members of his audience, most of them musicians, have come to meditate on the mystical sounds of Swami's kirtans. Carl, Carol, Gunther, Mike, David, the crowd from the Paradox had, and others joined him on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night. When he holds classes beginning punctually at 8 o'clock, the program consists of half an hour of chant of Hare Krishna, followed by a lecture from Bhagavad Gita, usually 45 minutes long, then a question and answer period, and finally another half hour of chanting, everything ending at 10 o'clock. The kirtan had just ended, and Swamiji is speaking. As spiritual beings, we are free to act, free to have anything, pure, no contamination, no disease, no birth, no death, no old age. And besides that, we have got many, many other qualifications in our spiritual life. When he speaks, he is pure spiritual form. The Vedic scriptures say that a sadhu, a saint, is not seen but heard. If the people in the audience want to know Swamiji, they will have to hear him. He is no longer simply the old Indian immigrant who lives on the other side of the partition of this loft, hanging his clothes to dry, barely getting his meals. But now he is speaking as an emissary of Lord Krishna, beyond time and space, and hundreds of spiritual masters in the chain of disciplic successions are speaking through him. He has entered amid New York's bohemian in 1966, saying that 1966 is temporary and illusory, that he is eternal and they are eternal. This was the meaning of the kirtan, and now he is explaining it philosophically, advocating a total change in consciousness. Yet, knowing that they can't take it all, he urges them to take whatever they can. You will be glad to hear that this process of spiritual realization, once begun, guarantees one to have his next life as a human being. Once karma yoga is begun, it will continue. It doesn't matter. Even if one fails to complete the course, still he is not loser. He is not loser. Now, if someone begins this yoga of self-realization, but unfortunately cannot prosecute this task in a nice way, if he falls down from the path, still there is encouragement that you are not a loser. You will be given a chance next life, and the next life is not ordinary next life. And for one who is successful, oh, what to speak of him. The successful go back to Godhead. So we are holding this class, and although you have multifarious duties, you came here twice a week and try to understand. And this will not go in vain. Even if you stop coming here, that impression will never go. I tell you, the impression will never go. If you do some practical work, that is very, very nice. But even if you do not do any practical work, simply if you give your submissive oral reception and understand what is the nature of God, if you simply hear and have an idea even, then you will be free from this material bondage. He is talking to a crowd who is deeply set in the hip life. He knows that they can't immediately give up taking drugs, and there they sit with their common law wives. Their path is to play music, live with a woman, and meditate sometimes, and be free. After hearing his lecture, they'll stay up all night with their instruments. Their women, their drugs, the interracial bohemian scene, that somehow they are drawn to Swamiji. He's got the good vibrations of the kirtan, and they want to help him out. They're glad to help, because he has no one. So Prabhupada is saying to them, that's all right. Even if you only can do a little, it would be good for you. We are all pure spirit souls, but you have forgotten. You have fallen into the cycle of birth and death. Whatever you can do towards reviving your original consciousness is good for you. There is no loss. Srila Prabhupada's Limrita, Planting the Seed, New York City, 1965 to 1966. Jai. Hare Krishna.